Our latest episode of Soundtracking, in association with the White Company, sees the return of one of our earliest guests. Over 100 episodes have passed since writer-director David McKenzie joined us to discuss Hell or High Water, which was scored by Nick Cave and Warren Ellis. Now he returns to discuss the fabulous Outlaw King, a passion project about Robert the Bruce, which is available to watch on Netflix now. As well as a score by Tony Dugan, Outlaw King features plenty of traditional Celtic and ecclesiastical music, which was sourced by music supervisor Jim Sutherland. Plenty more on that very shortly, but first a word from our friends at The White Company, who are on hand to help make your Christmas shopping less stressful. Now, there are some people in my family that are always very easy to buy for and some that are a little bit more tricky. So I love the idea of having somewhere I can buy gifts for everyone. And The White Company is just that place. Perhaps a scarf or gloves for my dad, stylish soft furnishings for mum and lovely books and soft toys for my nieces. You might prefer gift boxes for friends or a gift card or e-card for colleagues. It's all available from The White Company. The other great news is their premium gift box service, which means none of that dreaded Christmas Eve wrapping. You'll then get to spend more quality time with friends and family. What is not to love about that? Find out more about why they are the gifting destination at thewhitecompany.com or pop into one of their stores. Now, as I mentioned, The Outlaw King features both score and traditional music throughout. And in the case of this cue, well, a combination of the two.
Seb libera nos amado,
David, welcome back to Soundtracking.
Thank
We've done like
a 100
episodes since you were last on, but it was really lovely listening back to your episode because, I mean, we kind of ran through all your previous films, and one of the lovely things that you said in that was that you really try to do things differently musically with each film that you work on, and we'll get into the music in a minute, but congratulations on Outlaw King. It's stunning. Absolutely stunning. There's so much of it as well that's kind of that I'd really like to talk about, and I know that, correct me if I'm wrong, but this was in your head and a project you wanted to work on before Hell or High Water as well.
It's been around for about 6 years, and I wanted to tell that story of Robert, who is sort of a great Scottish folk hero in all sorts of ways, and you kind of grow up with a sort of mythological version of him, and just feeling like the time to tell the truthful story of him and to go for something that is demythologizing in some way and to try and dig a bit deeper into the realities of medieval life and his story just felt like something that needed to be done whenever possible. And after Hell or High Water, where we'd had some success there, the opportunity came to get the budget to do, you know, a film of that scale.
Yeah.
It needed to be done on a scale. And so that's how we found ourselves doing the film.
Yeah, you really humanise him. He was a real person and you really feel his journey and his emotions and his angst and his anger and his betrayal and all those things watching the film.
You're saying all the right things.
Oh, thanks! But was it easy to work out, because, you know, there's a big story there to tell over a long period of time, and to work out the time frame of which part of him you wanted to tell, was that easy to come?
No, it wasn't. That's part of the reason why the 6 years was, you know, it took that long, because, you know, the tendency is to start early and to end late. And in fact, the reality is that Robert didn't get to have his kingdom recognised by the Pope, which is a big important thing, and by the English king as well, until fairly near his death, you know. So this took an enormous amount of time, and then of course there's the Battle of Bannockburn, which is very famous.
Yeah.
But all the way through, I had this idea in my head that the period between William Wallace's death in 1305 and the Battle of Loudonhill in 1307, which is really concentrated where Robert sees the frustration of the people and anger at the brutality of what happened to Wallace and thinks, well, something else must be done. Mm. He tries to form an alliance with his arch rival, John Comyn. That goes wrong, and he ends up murdering him in the church. So he's outlawed, excommunicated, and then the Church of Scotland go, God, we have to, you know, take advantage of the one person who's left who could be our king.
Yeah.
And so they hastily arrange a coronation. He does all that. And then within days is roundly defeated in a surprise attack at the Battle of Methven, and is sent running with very, very few people left out to the Outer Isles.
Yeah.
And is basically a spent force. And then from that discovers that his wife and daughter have been captured, his brother's been hung, drawn and quartered, and pulls himself back to try and gather enough strength to start a guerrilla campaign and pushing back until eventually he brings an open battle to the fore. So I've given the whole story away. but that these are events that actually happened, and so the history is a gift in that period. And so it, you know, after lots of thinking about it, lots of worried about what he did in the sort of early parts of the Wars of Independence, I just threw away the front. Condense a lot of prehistory into the beginning of this. We've got an opening scene in the film which lasts for 8 minutes as a single take, and then just got on with that period of a year, and that was how we found our way through it. And we've been trying to be really faithful to the history, but also tried to make an entertaining movie.
Where did you start when you were thinking about the music for this? Because music was a big part of their world, you know, in terms of there wasn't much entertainment around, and music was very much part of that, both in terms of your working families or whatever, but also within the church and the religion side of things as well. It was very much a strong part of that. Where did you start and come into the music and how you wanted to cover it?
Well, the first thing I thought about is, as you say, everyone would have been singing. Everyone would have been making their own music because, you know, there's no recorded music for obvious reason, and the human sort of spirit is to always make music. And so I was thinking things like contemporary Africa, where everyone's just sort of spontaneously, you know,
stories,
drumming and singing,
as well.
and forming, you know, musical rhythms and things. And so the idea was to have diegetic, you know, like in-camera music in pretty much every scene. And I worked with a guy called Jim Sutherland, who I did a music video for many years ago. But, and him and I kind of tried to gather a collection of music that would have been contemporary at the time.
Yeah.
With a little bit of folk music that where you can't quite tell which century, but just trying to kind of get a sense of this choral music and they're singing and there's pipe. One of the weird things is that the Scottish bagpipes didn't exist at the time. In fact, they were English bagpipes, a very simple English bagpipe, but they were not Scottish bagpipes. But there were the thing called the triple pipes, where someone's blowing three pipes at the same time, and you have a drone, and so musically it sounds the same, it doesn't look the same.
Yeah.
So we played with that, and we had music in, you see in the credits a number of musicians there are singing Gaelic songs, and it was really important for me to do that. Ironically, when we did the very first cut of the film, it became clear that it was overwhelming that, so we dialed some of that back a little bit.
Okay.
But there was always going to be that presence of that thing, and then the other idea was to have score a little bit more abstract, a little, sometimes a little, fat cinematic music, sometimes just spacious music that was going to not sound too contemporary, but definitely not sound medieval, and the simple sort of phrases of medieval music. Thank you. So that I work with Tony Dugan. I work with him on Startup, yeah. And Tony's produced a lot of great Scottish bands, and and him and I kind of got together and took what we did on Startup on a much much larger scale. I collaborated with loads of musicians, had orchestras involved, and Tony's a genius, and you know, it was great just to kind of be able to work with him to push the music in certain directions, pull it back, and just play with the material.
It's really clever because there's a couple of scenes that really stayed in my head with regards to music and the singing, and there's what Florence when she's singing on the steps, you know, and he kind of goes, what's that song, you know, so like kind of, you know, as you would do now in terms of, and I mean talk about the casting, it's so perfect, and Florence is just the relationship between those two. And I know when I was reading that you know, the one thing that you love to do is to, you know, the script is not sacred for your cast. It's a starting point, and mm-hmm. you really want to give them that opportunity. They, you know, they own those characters, and they, you know, it's up to them to kind of try and pursue them, and you really see that relationship.
Well, the great thing is about that, I mean, you know, history is, Robert had an arranged marriage with King Edward's goddaughter, yeah. You know, and it turned out that they fell for each other. They were cruelly kind of ripped apart.
Yeah.
She was captured and spent many, many years in captivity, you know, down south. And then when she was released, she went back and they had a family and kind of lived happily ever after. And so that romantic arc is sort of true history, which is great. You know,
yeah.
And Florence and Chris were great together.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And it, you know, it's such a, you know, a male film, a pretty brutal film in many ways, but somehow or other, that, you know, what Florence brings to it and what Florence and Chris bring to it as Robert and Elizabeth is a totally different shade, and it works really well, I think, in the
yeah.
balance of the movie.
But it's a beautiful scene where she's just sat on the steps
singing Bonnie at Morn, yeah.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
The sheep's in the meadow and the cow is in the corn. Thou's over lying in thy bed, Bonnie at morn. Canny at need, Bonnie at morn. Thou's over lying in thy bed, Bonnie at morn.
And then on the islands as well, and I love as well, that's because, like you say, it's quite, you know, it's a male film. It was the time, and it was what's going, but the women had really important roles, and they were really, you know, when you see him return to the island and she comes up and she belts one, yeah. That's brilliant. You said 2 weeks or whatever, and then you have this beautiful scene of these women sitting singing, you know, a kind of a folk song or a local song, and those moments are beautiful, but they kind of show you the power of the women in those situations as well, I think.
Yes, I mean, obviously, you know, the men are, you know, doing the fighting and all
yeah.
that, but you know, it's a culture where everyone's got a place, and the singing scene. We had a scene in that unfortunately was cut, where, you know, behind the scenes at the wedding and all the staff all preparing stuff again, singing these amazing kind of
yeah.
Gaelic songs, and it just the attempt to try and depict medieval life, and the idea you have toil songs that basically, you know, keep you going through hanging seaweed or you know, drying fish or doing whatever you're
yeah.
doing to survive through the winter, you know, and,
yeah.
and I think, I mean, that tradition, I mean, it still exists in Gaelic culture, you know what I mean, and it has, you know, it's sort of uninterrupted for a long time, but, you know, obviously the 20th century and recorded music, you know, has changed that thing, but up until then, you know, within communities, people
yeah.
were singing their own songs and,
yeah.
and you know, ballads of stories that were, you know, meaningful to them, and tunes and rhythms that, you know, there's a hey titty tatty, you know, which the Scots are singing, you know, became the tune to Scots Were Hey, and you know what I mean? And these things kind of evolve. And,
yeah.
And it's really amazing to think of these roots kind of going back there and people singing versions of these songs actually at that time.
That have lasted hundreds of years. Yeah. It's amazing. With the religious side of stuff, which there's something incredibly hypnotic, I think, about music, particularly, you know, from hundreds of years ago around religion, and there's some wonderful scenes that are, you know, within the church at various ceremonies and stuff. How did you approach that? Is it better recorded, not in terms of physically recorded, but, you know, kind of documented with that type of music and what was around?
I mean, you do have an idea of what these masses were and things like that.
Yeah.
It is better. We had some advisors that were helping us with the wording and the, you know, the Jim was taking that music. Yeah, probably interpreting a little bit, but trying to get the impression of what's there. About the church back then is these amazing cathedrals that were, you know, I mean, we were filming in Glasgow Cathedral where Robert himself actually was, where Bishop, you know, actually was, and you know, these buildings they took 100 years to build. They, you know, in a prominent place, you'd walk in there with all this stained glass and all this incense, and you'd kind of think you'd arrived in heaven. You're hearing this incredible celestial music, and it's like, you come from the muddy fields and you're coming to this, you know, as an expression of something otherworldly.
Yeah.
These things must have been amazing. Our vision is obviously polluted by all these other things for us, but for somebody whose horizons were limited to what they had in front of them and what they were growing and what they were experiencing, to walk into a big cathedral and to hear those sounds and to see that architecture must just have blown your mind.
One bit of music that I wanted to speak to about, which I think is brilliant in terms of, like, when you talk about working with Tony, and it's when they're on the boat and you're talking about getting revenge, and it's this really subtle, you have to almost kind of really pay attention, slight electronic piece, but it's so powerful. It really works, I think, amazingly well.
It's interesting because we're trying not to kind of like take the world, you know, into a different place and with anachronistic music, but there is quite a lot of electronic music in there, and that. There are some pulses in there. We had this amazing thing where we went to these tanks in Inch and Down, which is up near Invergordon, mm-hmm. and they were Second World War oil tanks. And you walk down these really long corridors, and then you have to slide through an 18-inch pipe, and you're in this chamber. It's a big concrete chamber, and it has the longest natural reverb that anyone seems to have ever encountered. It's a 2+ minute reverb.
Wow.
And we went there with a couple of musicians, a lovely musician called Lucy Treacher, who we discovered on YouTube. She'd gone in there before, and she played the nickel harper and did some singing. And Greg Lawson does a violin, and we did some sort of call and response stuff with Lucy, one end of this enormous, I mean, it's huge, this chamber.
Wow.
And we had multiple microphones, and so this stuff's kind of like echoing around. And so, I mean, I think we should try and put a 5-1 version out of some of these things, because they are incredibly trippy. They're really, really amazing, and obviously entirely acoustic.
What an amazing length to go to, though, in terms of the sound for your film.
It was a little pilgrimage, and it kind of felt like a really interesting thing to do.
Yeah.
And it's there embedded in all sorts of other things in the film. And, oddly enough, a 2.5 minute reverb means that, in a 2-hour movie, you can't be playing with that too much. So it's definitely there. And it was one of the first things we did, and it felt like it was the beginning of the adventure that Tony and I went on. And so, as well as it being what it produced, the idea of sort of sliding through a pipe and breathing these oil fumes and all those kind of things was something to think about.
Is it really important for you to be part of that process and not just kind of go, okay, go and do your thing? I guess Warren and Nick, that was maybe more that type of process for Hell or High Water. But
yeah.
along the way, in a number of your films, you've been very, you've released a record. You've got that kind of thing where you've been fully involved in it.
I mean, with Hell High Water, we selected the tracks. So we did the kind of jukebox element, and Nick and Warren did the score element. But I sat with them in the room for some of it, and I really love working with them. It's great. The important thing for me this time was that the music is 100% recorded in Scotland, and so that was the genesis of the thing. And in some ways, film scores, if you're not careful, they can start becoming too musical.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important for somebody, I mean, I'm not musical, I love music, but I'm not, to somebody to kind of pull it down to earth and to make it spacious and to stop the melodies overriding and to let things breathe in their own right. And so in a way, that's part of my kind of influence on what's going on. And it is important. And I'm really glad to have had the chance to do it on a really big scale. yesterday we had to select some music for the red carpet, and so we put like 8 tracks of the film in there, and there's a huge variety of stuff, and you know, of course it ends with Catherine Joseph's amazing renderings of 2 of the great Scottish songs. And it was like I emailed him and said, "This is amazing, you know. We it's quite an achievement what we've done." And he was going, "I know, you know, it's great."
Did you film any of that? Of kind of, you know, in the tankard and all that kind of thing, and Catherine sessions and all that kind of stuff.
I tried to shoot a little bit of stuff in the tank, but it was black, pitch black. So there's some abstract stuff, you know. We didn't shoot Catherine doing her recording.
Next time you have to, the making of this
amazing,
is...
One take kind of extraordinary kind of, you know, raw performance. It's just incredible.
What conversation did you have with her prior to that? Did you kind of set out
Tony
any...
Tony knows her. That was all Tony. It's not, you know, but just the choice of doing Scots Way and the Land of Leal with her incredible voice and you know, not putting any embellishment on there. Mm-hmm. I'm really, you know, not many people sit to the credits in a movie, but you know, if you do, and I hope everyone does in Edinburgh on Friday,
that's
exciting.
Because
it's a really beautiful rendition of those 2 songs.
Yeah.
Scots, Wahi, we Wallace bled. Scots, when Bruce has often led. Welcome to your gory bed, or to
how did you? I mean, the battle scene towards the end of the film is brutal, and it's so immersive. It's, you know, you're there, you're kind of dodging almost as people and things are flying past you and stuff. How did you shoot that? I'm so intrigued as to how you shot that. But then also, you know, when you're putting it together, how are you deciding how you sound that scene as well?
Well, you know, putting it together to shoot was you know, working with the stunt team, the horse team, trying to kind of break it up into the biggest chunks you possibly can. You know, obviously you have to be safe, so you're not wanting to have more than 1 or 2 falling horses per thing.
But
always what I'd be saying to the guys is I don't really want to tell the story in the cuts where I can avoid it. I want the shots to last longer than they should do in conventional kind of action things. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing progression. Obviously sometimes we are cutting it up, but so you're trying to kind of create the biggest chunks possible and trying to create as much depth in the background as possible. We only had a week of main unit stuff on the battle, so all the stuff with the actors and was all done in that period of time, which is quite condensed. It was November. Late October, actually, and the sun was kind of, you know, getting lower and lower, and the weather was intermittent, but mostly on our side.
Yeah.
There were moments where I thought we're never going to get this done, and then there were moments where, you know, we just clarified and went into place. In terms of the sort of sound of the battle, you needed something, because there's so much clamour, you know, you need something to kind of that would build and poke through and then disappear again and poke through and disappear again and cohere the whole thing. And then there's a moment where you know, Robert falls on the ground, and there's a sort of danger moment, and we drop everything apart from the sort of, you know, the high end stuff, and then it kicks back in again. And so it's about cohering it, and then at the end of it, it's about trying to, you know, be quite emotional with the, you know, the sort of aftermath of battle and what that means.
Mm. Wait till my word.
Come
were quite specific about the locations and things, and a lot of the locations were true locations as to his journey and his story and stuff. Was that really important to you too, and why was that?
Well, I mean, it's important to try and, you know, if you're doing a historical drama, that you're trying to make an effort to be as honest as you can to, yeah, to medieval life and to the historical events, then it's important to try and get as close as you can. There, you know, also you have a logistical jigsaw puzzle that you've got to fit together. You know, the battle scenes we shot 20 minutes outside Glasgow because it was better to get there. Yeah. You know, and it's a jigsaw puzzle. And, mm-hmm, but trying to get the, you know, as much of the real things as possible. We filmed in Dunfermline, which is where Robert's we think his bones are, and
his heart's somewhere else apart.
His heart's in Melrose. Yeah. That's amazing. That's another amazing story. Is you know, after he, you know, on his deathbed, he'd still not been forgiven. Scotland had been recognised by the Pope, but he had not personally had his excommunication fully re-communicated, yeah, or whatever, and he felt he was still really kind of cut up by the kind of sacrilege of killing John Comyn in the church, and he asked James Douglas to take his heart with him to the Holy Land to try and, you know, get a bit penance and forgiveness, and James was on the way to the Holy Land and stopped in Spain, and the Spanish were fighting the Moors, and they asked him to help out, and he fell into a kind of classic trap. There was a few people on the hill, and he, mm-hmm, ran after them and came over the hill, and there was a whole army, and he was killed carrying Robert's heart.
Oh,
in a place called Tabor near Malaga.
Wow.
Which is really interesting. We found ourselves making a little pilgrimage there, which is pretty interesting. Anyway, that's a sidetrack.
That's the sequel.
I mean, the James Douglas story is pretty interesting because he's just a lunatic.
Oh, my God.
He just carries on being, doing raids and, just fighting.
Well, these are the great characters that, I mean, you don't, you know, kind of like, it's a bit like the supporting actor roles in films, isn't it? Everybody draws their attention to the leading men and ladies sort of thing. And these characters that you see behind Robert and stuff were so important to his journey and what, sure, he did. And Aaron in that role is just phenomenal.
He's great.
Oh,
he's
so great.
He really throws himself into it. And the relish and the kind of power. And also the thing is, because Robert's a contemplative man, and he's dealing with problems, and he's got, you know, he's wrestling with things, and Aaron's character, James Douglas, the Black Douglas, he's just on a revenge mission in a way, and so he's allowed to express some of the kind of pure rage, mm-hmm, and fury that Robert in a way is not allowed to, so it works as a really interesting foil.
Yeah.
I think
I remember being at school and having real problems in kind of connecting with when we were studying Shakespeare, and it was only after seeing Polanski's Macbeth that I was like, okay.
Now
I'm interested.
Okay.
Now I get the language, and now I want to know more. And I really think that this film should be part of syllabus for kids at school who are either into history or aren't, because it's so connecting, and I think it's just a story told so well that it'll go, all right. I just think it's had that same effect on me that it did when I saw...
Nothing would be, you know, give me greater pleasure than the idea of this film having a life that would continue, and you know, if it's something that people, you know, it's a little bit maybe too violent to show young people, but
yeah,
if it's something that can continue to have a life in a syllabus or something, that'd be fantastic.
Be amazing,
I'd be really, really, you know, I'd feel like it was a great conclusion to it.
Yeah. I read as well that, I mean, I've not seen this film, and I'd love you to kind of tell me if this is true and what this film means. But Tarkovsky's film has been a big inspiration. Andrei Rublev, is that right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
What is it about that film, and why has that been something that's inspired?
Well, it is one of the most extraordinary films ever made, and it's a very long kind of picaresque journey about the icon painter Andrei Rublev and his experiences, almost sort of wandering through Russia while historic events are happening. What it does... with some incredible, you know, some amazing long takes in that, which Tarkovsky's famous for, but this incredible sense of the mud and the reality and the brutality of medieval life in a way that no other film has ever done. I've seen it many, 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 many times, but, I guess in my 20s and thought, I want to do a Scottish film that, you know, because all those sort of night medieval movies were all kind of rather clean and colourful and didn't really kind of ever go that,
yeah,
that intense or sense of poetic reality, and you know, it's an extraordinary film. It's a slow burn, it's quite hard work, but I as a film lover, I know you'd love it. I mean, I really, really could not recommend it more highly.
And also just because of just kind of reading about the score and stuff as well, and is it of Nick, I can't even say his name now. Ovchinnikov, is that okay, it? Ovchinnikov, something like that. Yeah. But this kind of marriage of these two, you know, these creative worlds and what they've created with this film. So I'm going to.
It's one of the best ever.
Amazing. I'm going to go and watch it. Also, Chris Pine's accent. Absolutely spot on. It was amazing. Well, he's absolutely, I think it might be the best Scottish accent of a non-Scottish person I've ever heard.
Oh, that's really great to hear. We'll pass that on to him because
it doesn't sound like him. There's no kind of element of Chris Pine in that at all. It's so great.
He worked really hard on it, and it was really important to him. The irony, of course, is that 700 years ago they wouldn't have spoken anything like that anyway, and they would have all been probably speaking French and Gaelic, you know. So and kind of ancient English and Scots, you know. So, you know, obviously for the sake of accessibility, what we have is what we have.
Oh well, he nailed it. What's next?
I'm one of those people that can't really start thinking about the next thing until the last one's over. Mm. So I got ideas, but I just don't really want to have to go there yet. So I want to just chill out, hang out with my family, and
relish
just sort of get a sense of where the mm-hmm. the sort of urge wants to go. You know.
Well, thank you for this because it's absolutely brilliant. It's great to chat to you again.
Thank you. It's great. Really great chat to you, and really enjoy this show.
Thank you. From the score to the Outlaw King, that's Coronation by Tony Dugan, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with director David McKenzie, who also has a credit on the film's music. My huge thanks to David for taking the time to talk to us a second time round. The Outlaw King is available on Netflix now and is a wonderful, visceral piece of cinema. Before we go, you might have heard us over the last couple of weeks talking about an exciting new partnership we have with legendary guitar makers Fender to celebrate the launch of their Player series, a brand new line of electric guitars and basses. Now, this could be the perfect opportunity to take your guitar playing to the next level. The Player series is a range that has the signature sound and classic look of Fender, but with new technology, features and colours to handle any style of music. And the best news, you can win your choice of a Fender Player Series guitar or bass just by being a Soundtracking listener. All you've got to do is tell us your favourite piece of music in a film that features a guitar. Wayne's World? Roy Kuder's slide guitar on the score for Paris, Texas? Thomas Newman's wonderful work on American Beauty? Ultimately, it's totally up to you. So get thinking and you could be the proud owner of a new guitar or bass from the Fender Player series. But do hurry because entries close midday, Friday the 30th of November. Now, to enter, it is simple. Just email us your suggestions to Fender at Audioboom. And to find out more, head to audioboom.com/about/competition T&Cs, where you can find all the T's and C's. To celebrate the winning entries, we will be releasing a Fender Player series in association with Soundtracking Special on the 12th of December, where myself and some music specialists will be discussing your entries. So get thinking and send us your suggestions to fender@audioboom.com. Fender Player series, often imitated, never duplicated. Next up, I am beyond excited to finally share this episode with you. We have in the same room the director and the composer of Mission Impossible Fallout, Christopher McQuarrie and Lorne Balfe. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.